do better next time. Key areas to work on will be product performance, project scheduling, and balancing workloads. With considerable schedule slips, the Encarta project was not a model project from a management perspective. In fact, it is a case study in what not to do in scheduling software development on a multimedia project. Most problems on Encarta can be attributed to a single cause: lack of experience with MMPUBs, multimedia publishing products, on products of this size and complexity. With Encarta under our belt, we will not have to face this hurdle again on future projects. Process audits. One of the tasks that Maples asked Moore to perform as Director of Development was to conduct occasional process audits, usually of projects that were ongoing but running into some problems. In 1993, for example, Moore conducted 5 audits, each taking about a week of full-time effort. He usually looks at available project and quality data, talks to as many members of the project as possible, and tries to identify what they are doing well in addition to what they might do better. In general, Moore tries to find a process model that will make the group more successful, and then he either writes a report or presents detailed oral feedback to key project members. He presented his role as constructive. Mike Maples has had me go off and audit groups, too. That's always on demand, where there's a problem area or they need help. That's where I either play a cop or a hitman. They're just policing up before I'm in there, closing down, making changes. This is where I go in and audit. I basically start out with, "I'm here to help you." I inventory and disseminate best practices. I'm here to capture the best practices that you have. And as they're describing what their best practices are, I also ask what problems they're having. If there are problem areas or practices that I believe could be improved in their group, then I'll make recommendations for improvement. I always view the audits as a constructive process where I'm there to help them. I can almost say that the job I'm doing today is a full-time auditor. Despite the pressure of the audits, Moore primarily works as an evangelist, gently trying to coax groups toward better practices by the power of logic and data from other projects. We have noted that a cultural resistance within Microsoft to mandates from executives, bureaucratic rules, or a company quality assurance QA staff makes it difficult to tell people what to do. Fitting with Microsoft's culture, Moore asked people to view his audits as a form of technical exchange. This is probably my personal struggle. There isn't a management mandate for structure. It's just technical exchange. I don't walk into someone's office and say, "Mike has told me to carry the banner of structure, and you will comply with these standards." It's, "How are you doing this stuff? Have you tried this technique? This may solve that particular problem." That's the type of discussion. These groups pick the mode that fits the problems that they're solving. You've probably noticed there isn't a QA group going around auditing these groups. We don't have that traditional QA. One group that Moore helped turn around developed the Visual C++ language product. Mike Maples had met with members of the project during a routine program review session. After identifying several problems, he sent Moore in for an audit. The group had 30 to 40 developers, an equal number of testers, and about 10 program managers, but was still using ad hoc practices. Jeff Beeler, a program manager, described changes the team made after encountering Moore. Dave spent about 2 weeks interviewing key members of the product team and came back with a list of recommendations, suggestions for development, suggestions for testing, and suggestions for program management administration. Many of those recommendations were adhered to. Sometimes we had to implement them by just brute force. "You will implement this. We've got Dave Moore saying that this stuff is really good stuff. Let's make sure it happens in this project." As for others, the suggestions made perfect sense, and we just acted on them. Others never got implemented. Most importantly, the group adopted the daily build process, scheduling by milestones and small tasks, and reviewing code before checking it into the build. Chris Williams applauded the results of this audit. The Visual C++ group was completely off the rails, and C7, C++ version 7, was a 12-month project that shipped 13 months late. They called Dave and said, "Dave, help." Dave came in and said to them, "Okay, you need to follow these kinds of processes. You need to do these kinds of things." And these guys completely reconstructed the way they do business. They're shipping stuff on time and correctly. Retreats. In the early 1980s, Microsoft started the practice of holding at least one retreat a year for key members of the company. One purpose is to exchange information on what different divisions are doing. Another is to tackle such issues as how to compete more effectively in particular product areas. One 1983 retreat targeted Lotus and ended up defining the new Excel product. Or how to improve product development and customer support processes. At some sessions, the organizer has asked attendees to read a classic work in software engineering or related areas, such as Phil Crosby on quality or Tom DeMarco on project scheduling, and then discuss the insights from these authors and improvements that Microsoft might attempt. Senior people have reported on the readings first and led the discussions. Perhaps the most famous retreat, immortalized within Microsoft by Chris Mason's Zero Defect Memo, was the May 1989 meeting that focused on techniques and tools to reduce defects and improve quality. About 30 people attended this retreat, which Dave Moore organized as part of his new job as Director of Development. Moore divided the attendees into four groups and asked them to focus on zero-defect methods, tools, and other related areas. He recalled the meeting and the role of Mike Maples. "I talked with Jeff Harbers, then Moore's boss, about how we needed to make some changes, and I just wasn't getting anywhere. I was working with my groups to make things improve. Jeff was trying things too. But there wasn't this cohesive, we need to understand the process, we need to have concepts like zero defects moving. The fundamental change for understanding the process really would have to have come when Mike Maples came on board in September of 88. At that time, I really worked with Mike to define the structure of this retreat that set off zero defects. I'd been thinking about the concept for a while. I'm sure other people had been thinking about the concept for a while. But I got those folks together in a room. Charles Simone was part of that group, in fact, on zero defects. I just happened to pick Chris Mason as the guy to lead that particular group. And fortunately, that setting, that structure, the problems we had seen, allowed us to capture the concepts we needed to expose to the application development teams at the time. Microsoft has continued holding retreats every year on a variety of issues. Meetings between 1993 and 1995 focused on issues that have challenged Microsoft to operate more as an integrated company, as well as to prepare for such new technologies as online networks and multimedia. For example, a June 1993 retreat discussed the problem of improving synergies among the different products and business units. Another in February 1994 discussed managing interdependencies. How to deal with the growing problems of scheduling and quality assurance when projects depended on key components developed in other projects or imported from outside the company. Chris Williams recalled that some 35 development managers and test managers from around the company attended this three-day retreat. Mike Maples and Dave Moore actually hosted it and put it together. I think it was the result of a fairly widespread concern over our increasing componentization and increasing interdependence and lack of ability to manage effectively our interdependence and our process problems. So there were groups that were defined to look at managing dependencies, to look at, if we are short in some significant tool areas, how can we go about reducing bugs exposed to testing? Those sorts of things. Several key interdependencies now exist. For example, Visual Basic for Applications, developed in the languages area, and OLE, developed in the business systems division, are critical parts of Excel and other applications that utilize these technologies. The Office product unit must coordinate the development of Excel, Word, PowerPoint, Mail, and Access, which all need to ship together. Williams explained that Office now has less problems because it is all under Chris Peters. One of the reasons why Office, for example, works highly effectively is because they're all in one organization. It's when it crosses these divisions that things get to be so much of a problem. A specific idea that came from the February 1994 retreat was to create a contract template between two interdependent groups. This will also serve as a sort of best practices checklist for managing relationships between interdependent groups, spelling out who should do what in the development and testing phases, and by when. Cross-group sharing. Microsoft now has so many divisions that, as in any large company, people in one area are not necessarily well informed about what people in another area are doing. Retreats help to disseminate information, but these exchanges are infrequent and at a high level. Managers such as Dave Moore have thus encouraged middle managers and other people to share what they learn more frequently and in less formal settings. One key mechanism has been regular lunch meetings for managers in the same functions. Mark Olson, test manager in the Excel group, explained how, even prior to the formation of the Office product unit, he had regular interactions with his counterparts in other groups. On the testing level, I speak quite frequently with the Word testing manager. We're making a lot of effort to have features that work well between Word and Excel. We have testers hooked up who are working on similar features across their groups, so they share ideas and information. We share tools back and forth. We meet once a month right now for lunch for 2 hours, the test managers from Word, Excel, and Project. We talk about, what are we facing? How did you solve this problem? I'm thinking about this issue. What did you guys do? We meet monthly with all of the test managers within the company, within the worldwide product group. We do a presentation, and we all share what our groups are doing. Chris Williams is another strong proponent of these regular but informal meetings. Managers from user education and testing seemed most enthusiastic about them. Development managers, however, did not show up in large numbers at the meetings Moore had organized, a source of frustration for Moore and Williams. How to get people doing a lot more of this cross-pollination is one of the more interesting problems we've got. The director of user ed has what they call a museum meeting, where the Microsoft user ed managers get together once a week. They sit down for an hour. Each group talks about what their products are and where they're going with their product and exposes everybody to that. And then they go into various topics. They go into HR issues. They go into technological issues. They bring in outside speakers. The testers have a once-a-month meeting where the test managers get together and they come up with a year's worth of subjects to discuss. That seems to work out well for them. Dave Moore used to have a monthly development managers meeting in which he'd get 15% of them to show up. Program managers meet regularly in what they call blue tray lunches, where people give talks to share experiences or information on particular projects. Microsoft records some on videotape and circulates them. Developers in particular groups also meet regularly. Excel developers, for example, meet weekly for brown bag lunches where people talk about different areas of the code to help new people learn the product and to familiarize experienced people with changes or areas they did not know about yet. Sometimes they circulate memos on the code details. Even without regular meetings, ideas move across Microsoft fairly quickly. It is possible, for example, to connect people from the same function through electronic mail aliases or group addresses. These allow, for example, Dave Moore to send a message to all development managers or Roger Sherman to send a message to all test managers. Moore, in particular, uses electronic mail in this way to share good ideas, summarize findings from new books or articles, and make suggestions for readings. People also move around the company, taking good ideas with them. As Dave Moritz, formerly the testing manager for Windows and MS-DOS, noted, "We basically are very incestuous in the way that we move around between divisions here." Eating your own dog food. Another mechanism for learning is a concept that Microsoft people refer to as eating your own dog food. We noted in Chapter 5 that this means groups building a particular product should, as soon as possible, use that product in their own work. If the product tastes no better than dog food, it is too bad. The cooks and everyone else still have to eat, use it. For example, managers insist that the team building Windows NT or Windows 95 self-host or use that product as their operating system as soon as there is a stable version. Then the team can test it for bugs themselves. The Word and Excel groups will use the new versions of these products while under development to write memos or keep track of project data. A broader application of this idea is for Microsoft groups to use Microsoft tools and commercial products in their own work to experience and see what customers see and provide instant feedback to other groups. For this reason, Bill Gates mandated that program managers use Visual Basic for prototyping, and Steve Ballmer mandated that Microsoft's Internal Management Information Systems, MIS people, use Windows NT when it was in an early stage of development. Similarly, Microsoft groups generally use Microsoft's commercial language compilers rather than make or buy more specialized development tools. Dave Thompson, a development manager in the NT group, commented on the role of Gates and Ballmer. What those guys do is try to make sure that the right natural forces are in place. Telling the MIS group to use the stuff puts in place the right natural forces to make the product great, because you have a bunch of users who are going to beat up on a bunch of providers until it's right. Another example is when Visual Basic was under development, and the guys that do the network administration tool development that were in my group were mandated by Bill to use Visual Basic to develop those tools. They didn't like it at all. They weren't basic programmers. They were object-oriented C++ programmers. Well, they did it anyway, and as a result, they forced a number of significant improvements to Visual Basic. Bill had accomplished his goal. He forced the VB guys to make improvements, and the VB guys, when they delivered the product, acknowledged the contributions of this development group, which gave them lots of feedback from using their stuff. So these guys will intervene to have the right natural tensions in place. Rick Rashid has played a similar role with Windows NT. As the chief designer of Mach, a Unix-based microkernel operating system that influenced NT's design, he was able to use and test NT and make comparisons to his own system. Bill Gates did not hire Rashid to oversee NT, but he relied heavily on Rashid's evaluations. In other words, Gates had another natural force in place to scrutinize a crucial new product and help him guide the project. In the case of NT, we have the guy who created Mach here running our research group. He was always looking over NT, pointing out any case where it wasn't able to beat Mach. And his group became a source of a lot of good suggestions. It worked out to the benefit to NT. We didn't hire Rick to say, "You're the shadow NT oversight committee." With Word and Excel, I've grown up with them. I know the algorithms there. I know all those developers. NT was something fairly new. So from time to time, I'd ask Rick, "What do you think of this thing?" There's a lot of people willing to provide criticism of another team's projects around here. Another part of this idea of eating your own dog food is that developers should use computers that the average user would have, not a super machine with lots of RAM and hard disk storage space. Senior Vice President Brad Silverberg, as head of the Windows group, recounted his feelings on this precept, which Microsoft does not always follow. Windows is so dependent upon fitting the needs of the installed base that it is very important the product run well on a typical 4 to 8 megabyte memory machine. Well, if you give your developers fast 486s with 16 megs, the performance that they see is completely unconnected with the performance your customer is going to see. What runs great in 16 megs might thrash like crazy in 4 meg. You can't just say, "Okay, I have a test machine. I'll run it every now and then on my 4 meg machine." So what I do is, I make sure my developers have machines that are comparable to the machines I expect my customers to have. And so my developers typically have 4 or 8 meg machines. It's a little bit controversial at times, because a lot of developers want the fastest machine, the coolest technology. They don't always understand, but it works. If you look at my track record, every time I've had a project where the developers did have the kind of hardware that was a generation beyond what the customers had, the product always had performance problems. One recent case was the internal and beta testing for the double space feature in MS-DOS 6.0. Microsoft relied heavily on tests with 1,000 of its own employees, who generally ran Windows and new applications programs. Microsoft's 5,000 beta testers for this product had characteristics similar to the internal Microsoft users. They tended to run Windows and new Windows applications. DoubleSpace encountered some problems, though, when running on old or faulty hardware and with certain old DOS applications. It also had a tendency to clash with a memory-saving feature in MS-DOS 6.0 called Smart Drive when used with DOS, but not Windows. There were indications of these problems before Microsoft shipped the product, but they were extremely infrequent and difficult to replicate. Nonetheless, tens of millions of MS-DOS users who had not upgraded to Windows bought MS-DOS 6.0 because of the data compression and memory enhancement features. They also continued to use old DOS applications because their machines were too old and small to upgrade. Many of these users then encountered problems with DoubleSpace, forcing Microsoft to issue a new release of MS-DOS 6, for which it charged customers a small fee. As Ben Slivka, development manager for MS-DOS 6.0, recalled, "At the time we shipped, there were two problems I knew of. One was that a certain class of copy-protected applications wouldn't run, and our feeling was that there were very little of those out there anymore. The user had to be someone who had this old application and hadn't upgraded the application, but he was going to upgrade the operating system. It was hard for us to understand who that person was going to be. Our theory there is that people who bought Windows 3.1 were pretty likely to buy MS-DOS 6, and machines were shipping with Windows 3.1. The class of people who were going to buy MS-DOS 6 but didn't have Windows 3.1 seemed to be pretty small. My understanding from the marketing guys is that there's a class of people who tend to upgrade, and then there's a class of people who just don't. We did these random digit dial surveys afterwards to find out who was buying it, and 80% or 90% of the people who bought MS-DOS 6 upgrades had Windows and a 386 machine. That data matched with our expectations. Also, we felt like we were shielded by Windows 3.1. But, in retrospect, maybe we weren't really, and we didn't think that through as carefully as we should have. We had over 1,000 people at Microsoft internally running DoubleSpace. We weren't seeing any problems. Our beta testers and our beta forum in January were saying, 'Ship it, ship it. It's ready.' Although hindsight is 20/20, we think Microsoft could have caught and fixed these problems. Company testers, as well as internal users and beta users, could have experimented with DoubleSpace in everyday situations on old DOS machines and with a greater variety of DOS applications. But MS-DOS 6.0 and DoubleSpace also provided an opportunity for learning. As we discussed in Chapter 5, for Windows 95, its next major release of an operating system, Microsoft extended the period for internal development and testing. It also increased the number of beta testing sites to 400,000. Although the product is a year and a half late and some features still have serious problems, these and other measures reduced the likelihood of a major bug going undetected because of a rushed ship date or inadequate beta testing. Principle: encourage feedback and improvement using quantitative metrics and benchmarks. Many companies have found that a key element in managing as well as improving activities such as product development is to create quantitative metrics and benchmarks. Metrics are statistical measures and data that can evaluate quality or characterize key elements of products and processes, at least partially in response to problems documented in the postmortem reports. Microsoft projects have gradually adopted a small number of metrics that they use consistently. Managers primarily refer to these metrics to make key decisions in projects, such as when to move forward in a milestone or ship. In addition, quantitative metrics and data have served as feedback to help projects share information and improve. Microsoft managers are also now trying to use metric data to create company-wide benchmarks that capture best practice development methods. These benchmarks should make it easier for all groups to contribute their good practices as well as learn from one another. The data collection process for the benchmarks extends the project postmortem documents. We mentioned earlier that some other companies are more advanced than Microsoft in their use of quantitative metrics and data for software development. Microsoft people also acknowledge that they can do more to identify metrics and accumulate project data that capture, in a transferable way, more of the reasoning behind the decisions of experienced and successful managers. Nonetheless, metrics and data have long had a special place in Microsoft. In their absence, people may attempt to base decisions on emotional or subjective arguments, or debate endlessly whether to include a particular feature, release a product, or adopt a different practice or tool. Microsoft groups still have these arguments, but emotional reasoning and political positioning have never worked well with Bill Gates or other senior Microsoft managers. Dave Moore, for example, commented on the importance of using data to back up suggestions that people make in program reviews. If the person isn't presenting these suggestions with technical data, it's just going to be ignored. And these people know that. Anything that's emotionally or politically backed, just ignore it. Nothing's going to happen. But if it's technically backed, and it comes up in a program review that someone suggested you do something technically and you ignored it, you didn't avail yourself of all the data to make the decision, then you're going to get totally ripped and torn apart in that program review. It's going to be the major disaster of your life. Quantitative data does seem to attract respect in Microsoft. This consensus within the company leads us to believe that Microsoft has considerable potential to improve its ability to use metrics as well as benchmarks. These should help the company manage projects more effectively in the short term, as well as improve development processes and products at more fundamental levels. Metric categories. We have already seen in chapters 4 and 5, as well as in the overview of the postmortem reports, examples of the kinds of metrics and data used at Microsoft. We will discuss other examples later in this chapter in our treatment of Microsoft's usability lab and customer support organization. Overall, these metrics fall into three broad categories, and they measure or track characteristics of the following. Quality includes bug, error detection, and fix rates per day and week, bug severity, bug resolution, bug cluster analysis, bugs found per 1,000 lines of source code, usability lab results, customer satisfaction, and frequency of customer problems. Product includes type and number of features, product size in lines of source code, bytes of memory, and bytes of executable files, change in product size from one version to the next, degree of code reuse, speed and memory usage, and code test coverage. Process includes feature team sizes, estimated and actual completion dates for features, milestones, and shippable products, schedule slippage, checklists for milestone completion, and effectiveness of methods for finding bugs. Managers use this quality, product, and process metric information throughout a project. Before a project begins, they apply the metric data to help forecast resource needs, such as the number of developers and testers. They also try to forecast scheduling requirements, such as the length of integration or buffer time. During a project, managers, as well as developers and testers, use the metric data to obtain feedback on progress, stability, and performance indicators. After completing a project, they use the metric data to characterize projects, identify problem areas, evaluate the effectiveness of bug-finding techniques, explore multiple project trends, and highlight opportunities for improvement. Debates still continue in the company, however, about the meaning or generality of some metric data that Microsoft groups and other companies have collected. It is also easy to misinterpret specific metric numbers. Accordingly, Microsoft personnel, as well as other people, need to carefully describe why and in what context they collected the metric data. We can see in Microsoft, for example, particular efforts to distinguish the characteristics of applications as opposed to systems, products, and projects. Both applications and systems projects in Microsoft focus extensively on bug metrics. Systems projects, however, place more emphasis on performance metrics that characterize the execution speed and memory usage of a product. Efficient execution of the low-level functions in systems products is absolutely critical, because higher-level applications products execute these functions repeatedly. Users also demand fast interactive responses from the applications. In fact, the memory usage of a systems product, such as whether it requires 4, 8, or 16 megabytes of memory, directly translates into the size of its potential market sales. For example, many older or low-priced PCs contain only 2 megabytes or 4 megabytes of memory and are unable to run systems products such as Windows NT, which can require 16 megabytes of memory. In contrast, applications products tend to emphasize metrics for the product ship date and the intermediate milestone dates. Applications projects usually release new products every 12 to 24 months and cut features, if necessary, to meet target dates. Systems projects often prefer to postpone the release date, if necessary, because they must deliver an indivisible set of product features that support many different user scenarios. Example: bug severity metrics. The metrics most widely used in projects throughout Microsoft deal with various errors or defects that routinely appear in software products. Most people in the software industry refer to these as bugs. Bug detection and correction activities are inherent parts of developing software at Microsoft or any other company. Because Microsoft developers write a lot of code and create daily incremental builds of products, they produce, as well as fix, a lot of bugs. Hence, it is not surprising that so many metrics focus on bugs. As discussed in Chapter 5, bug data reflect the overall quality of a product and the degree and rate of improvement in product quality during development and testing. Microsoft projects also use metrics that characterize the types of problems that occur and identify areas for improvement, as well as assess progress and evaluate the readiness of a product for release. Ultimately, the number of bugs on a project is a function of many things: the skill of the people, the number of people, especially new hires, changes in the specification, the amount of new and changed code, difficulty of understanding the code, thoroughness of testing, compatibility with other products, and other factors. Projects categorize bugs using a variety of schemes to identify their severity, how and when they were detected, when they were resolved, and how they affected features in the product. Most groups rely on a 4-level severity classification scheme that resembles others in the software industry. Severity 1. The bug causes the product to halt, crash, or be inoperable. Severity 2. The bug causes a feature to be inoperable and an alternative, workaround solution is not possible. Severity 3. The bug causes a feature to be inoperable and a workaround solution is possible. Severity 4. The bug is cosmetic or minor. Microsoft detects and corrects these bugs prior to the final public release of a product. For this particular set of projects, the bug data suggests a downward trend in the percentage of level 1 bugs in products released from year to year. For example, MacWord 4.0 came out in April 1989 and had 31.5% level 1 bugs. Works for Windows 2.0 appeared in September 1991 and had 21.2% level 1 bugs. Money 2.0 was released in August 1992 and had 10.2% level 1 bugs. Improvement in software development methods provides one possible explanation for this trend. Managers also like to see the percentage of higher severity bugs decrease from one product version to the next version. For example, the percentages of higher severity bugs, levels 1, 2, and 3, decreased slightly between MacWord 4.0 and MacWord 5.0. If this trend continued for this particular product, it would suggest that developers were adding or changing features in a less error-prone manner. Limitations of current metrics. Microsoft's current metrics are simply a minimal or perhaps sub-minimal set. They need to include much deeper process and product metrics that help anticipate and understand problems before they occur. Projects then would have more lead time to prevent problems or at least prepare to react to them. Companies such as Motorola, Hewlett-Packard, NEC, and Hitachi have successfully applied metrics to accomplish these deeper goals. Mike Maples argued, however, that Microsoft people find and fix more bugs than they formally count. The only reservation I have about KLOC, the thousand lines of code metric, is that we're not as rigorous as some people in tracking it. In errors per KLOC, we don't record all the errors that developers find in design reviews and the errors that the developer finds as he's writing his code. Now, as a concept, we want to keep moving more and more of the error finding earlier and earlier in the project. Zero defects and a lot of things keep moving errors early in the project, but the way we do our counting would make it look like there are fewer bugs found. Furthermore, even though Microsoft collects and uses a variety of metric data, its projects still rely on many subjective rules of thumb that the company has not yet quantified into metrics. Dave Moore tried to capture this subjective knowledge using metrics and collections of historical data, but he encountered resistance from developers and managers who argued that their projects or products were unique or different. Chris Williams commented on this frustration. One of the problems we've got is that we have a great deal of this seat-of-the-pants information that is very, very poorly transmitted from one person to another. You look at the kinds of things that Chris Peters and some of these people who have shipped a lot of software know. They just know it in their gut. It's very difficult for them to get it into a form that can be transmitted. So we end up with a videotape of Chris talking about it. Well, that's not good enough. Chris, come on. What was the thing that kicked you over into thinking this wasn't going to ship? It's a metric. It's an I looked at the bug open-close chart, and it just looked wrong to me. Why did it look wrong? It's just that there are people who give seat-of-the-pants data, but they don't refer to them as metrics. Metric-based process improvement. In 1994, Mike Maples created a new organizational structure to bring together people focusing on process improvement and training within the functional groups. He tapped Chris Williams, who had been somewhat outspoken with regard to the need to be more systematic in software development, to become director of product development and head of the new structure. Williams, a 38-year-old computer science graduate from Bowling Green University, had been working for Fox Software as a development manager when Microsoft acquired this company. He worked in compiler development for Microsoft before taking on the new post. Under the reorganization, all of the functional directors now report to Williams. These include the directors of testing, development, program management, user education, and internal tools. Also reporting to Williams are the manager of training, who heads a group of 14 Microsoft people, plus some outside contractors, and the manager of usability testing, who heads a group of 30 to 35 people. The total number of people reporting to Williams is around 100, including Middle East product development, which has special language needs. Williams viewed the reorganization as a deliberate effort to improve knowledge transfer, self-examination, and learning across the different groups. These goals have taken on a new importance in Microsoft because product units are now trying to share more components. Projects now need to predict schedules and produce quality products for each other, as well as for outside customers. They can no longer focus solely on creating the best possible product for their own needs or for their individual set of customers. I think the big thing that Dave Moore, other people, and I have recognized is that our development process has been so focused on creating an outstanding product that, in some cases, we've driven toward that at the expense of following a procedure that allows us to control the process. Some groups have obviously done more of it than others, but it's been largely inconsistent. we don't do a good job of leveraging between the groups and sharing the lessons learned between them. So my focus is headed towards trying to leverage as much as possible the knowledge that people have gained from one group to another, as well as to get people to do more self-examination of how they do things so they get better at them. We're surrounded by incredibly bright people who, if given the priority of figuring out the best possible procedures to do something, will be very good at it. But in the past, their priority has been always to create the best possible product at the right time in the marketplace. And we're now starting to learn, as we get more componentized and more interdependent, that having some common practices and procedures is important. Process-focused, not product-focused, postmortems. As part of this initiative for process improvement, Chris Williams, Roger Sherman, Dave Moore, and others are now working to improve metrics both for technical developers and project managers. In particular, they see the need for more process metrics that explain why something went wrong during a project, as opposed to just what went wrong. In addition, projects sometimes do not use the same terms or do not define them consistently, a situation that Williams and other managers plan to change. For example, Microsoft does not really have a uniform definition for the pivotal milestone term, code complete. Williams and his team also intend to modify and extend the project postmortem process to incorporate more metric data, including both the gathering of new data and the sharing of relevant existing data. Finally, they hope to use the metric data to define and communicate company-wide benchmarks that capture best practice development methods. Williams is especially anxious to take the postmortem process to the next level. Groups have done a fine job of chronicling their problems in these reports, but the postmortems often fall short on analyzing why problems occur and what solutions are possible. Furthermore, individual groups do not have a consistent process in place to ensure that they do not repeat the same mistakes in future projects, nor is there a systematic way for projects to learn from one another. Williams observed, for example, that almost every postmortem in every group cites problems with schedules getting out of control because team members keep adding features. Consistently, you go back through them and you will always find a significant, "I'm out of control because I haven't shut the faucet off on the features." It's sad that we learn that lesson over and over. I think in some measure that's the way things are. I think in another measure it's because we do a lousy job of estimating. Therefore, we do a lousy job of costing the additional feature when we get around to it. One of the things that Dave Moore did very well was to get people to take a look at their postmortem process and how they did things. People have done a very good job at the time of a postmortem of examining how they did things and what could have gone better. The only problem we've had is that they haven't made it into a cycle of reevaluating, establishing some new priorities, and moving ahead. They say we're going to change it, but nobody says we're going to change it by how much. And nobody stops to look 6 months later, "Did you change it by that much?" Postmortem is a phase that everyone has built into their brains already. Everyone understands what it means, and everybody counts on spending some time doing that. We just want to focus a little bit less on what happened and focus more on how it happened. How did you get out of control? Not "so-and-so never gave me the bug list when I needed it," but "what was missing in order to make sure you got a bug list when you needed it?" The problem with the postmortem is it's not done in an orderly fashion where you work your way through the development process from the beginning to the end. And that's what we were hoping to control. Largely what's captured now on a postmortem is pissing and moaning. Dave Moore agreed with this assessment of the postmortems. "The whole thing about postmortems is that it's good to have them, but people complain about the same problem over and over again. A lot of whining, that sort of thing. A lot of times, that's all it is. Get it off your chest." "Okay, fine, it's off your chest. Go try and make some improvement." That applies to some of the things that are in the postmortems. There's other stuff in the postmortems we definitely should have been fixing. There should have been accountability for making improvement in the process for the next release. Best practice benchmarking. The best practice benchmarking idea combines the concept of a postmortem with a process audit. It should also take less time than writing up a postmortem report, and it should create an easily shared list of good practices. To do this, Williams, Sherman, and Moore have been devising best practice benchmarking questions. For example, did development deliver a detailed testing release document or a similar document with the release? Did you estimate the number of bugs to be found in Milestone X? Did you review your feature list? These may serve as a basis for process audits and provide a framework for conducting a partial benchmark analysis during a project, after Milestone 2, for example. This would provide some early in-process or leading indicators if a project is in trouble or not. The full benchmarking process will examine internal practices for each function, compare practices in different groups, and compare Microsoft performance with external process benchmarks and performance standards. These might include the Software Engineering Institute and the International Standards Organization, or industry customer satisfaction data. Williams explained the goals. We're working to develop a system of process assessment that will be very much tuned to our development process. This is substantially different than your standard consultant relationship with his vendor or with his supplier. We're calling it our Best Practices Benchmark Program. We are developing a set of development practices all the way through the entire process that people should be paying attention to. We want to use a postmortem as an opportunity to benchmark yourself. How did you do things against the best wisdom we've gathered to date? We presume this will evolve into a standard. Our goal is to lay out some fairly concrete metrics at that time. We're probably going to end up with something in the neighborhood of 250 guidelines. Williams will not force groups to do the benchmarking, but he is starting with projects that have expressed an interest. If this benchmarking effort succeeds, Williams will have the metrics that he wants for groups to manage projects more effectively, as well as learn from each other more systematically. Like Dave Moore before him, however, Williams expects to encounter resistance, especially since his new team is attempting a much broader initiative to influence how projects organize and manage themselves. We're very interested in not making this be a radical departure, but being an encouragement for self-examination. The last thing I want is someone to come into it as if they were going to a dental exam. So what we want to do is first work with groups that are interested and have already expressed an interest. Then I plan to go selling to groups after that. And I presume that at that point, some groups will have found this of interest and discussed it with other groups, and there will be some groundswell of value here seen. My gut feel is that 75% to 80% of the groups will decide that this is of value and want to do this. Over a period of 18 months or 2 years, we'll have gotten there. I think that this program will be an abject failure without some ability to correlate metrics to it. I'm a big fan of, you can't control what you can't measure. I don't necessarily think we need to be wildly anal and be tracking all kinds of things, but I think we don't do a very good job of tracking a bunch of things in a consistent fashion, like, for example, bugs per developer week. One of the things that I'm pushing for right now is that we do a lousy job of examining estimated versus actual, particularly with elapsed time. So, for example, a developer will say, I think that'll take me 3 weeks. And 4.5 weeks into it, we'll go, are you done yet? And he'll go, almost. Then he finishes and we go, whew. We never stop to say, okay, that took you 4.5 weeks. Why? What was wrong? What kinds of things did you run into? Roger Sherman, who became director of testing in 1993, is especially concerned with writing process documents that capture good practices. Only a few groups did this during 1988 and 1999, following a Maples request after he first came to Microsoft. See Chapter 1. Sherman joined Microsoft in 1988 after studying computer science and music at Oberlin College. He worked at Boeing and then entered Microsoft as a tester in consumer software. His group wrote a document on their development and testing processes in 1988, but did not update the material. Sherman is also now looking to define common terms and metrics so that Microsoft groups can learn from different projects more consistently, and define a standard process that they can all work together to improve. What I'm doing is writing a document, an updated version of all of these, with commonly defined terms. Then I plan to take that to the development community at Microsoft and say, I'd like for us to agree that this should be the standard way in which we develop products. Now, there are a couple of things to say that are fairly important. One is, what I mostly would like to get is a standardized set of terminology, so that when we pull metrics out of multiple products, we can do valid comparisons. I think this is a strategic advantage that Microsoft has. We've got so many development projects going on that we can learn a lot faster about what works and what doesn't work because of the multiple instances of these projects. But if one group defines what code complete is in a completely different way than another group, then all your statistics are bad. The second thing is, I'd like to have a standard off-the-shelf process. I don't want it to be a cohesive process. I would like people to experiment with it. When they do something that's different, I would like them to register what they're doing with us so that we can track it as a difference. And if it works better, spread the word about that or change the standard to accommodate it. I would like to see this become a best practices document that is constantly updated and incorporates the best practices that we know and does not become a bureaucratic, burdensome thing. Principle: view customer support as part of the product and as data for improvement. In addition to trying to learn more from internal sources, company projects, Microsoft has recently made extraordinary efforts to learn from external sources, its tens of millions of customers. Customers can be an invaluable source of information, and they now have many opportunities to provide feedback directly into Microsoft's product development groups. For example, program managers analyze activity-based planning data as well as information from customer wish lines and monthly offline plus reports that analyze customer calls. Program managers and developers test prototypes in Microsoft's usability labs during projects. Projects also release an alpha version of their product for internal use and feedback. An external beta release to selected customers follows for real-life testing. Developers then rely on this feedback to make additional refinements before releasing a final product to manufacturing and the marketplace. Even Microsoft's Product Support Services, PSS, division uses the usability labs to conduct what it calls supportability testing. This examines how difficult new features are to support, as well as experiments with different ways of diagnosing problems. After shipping a new product, Microsoft puts developers and testers on PSS phone lines and in situation room teleconferences with PSS personnel from Microsoft's various support centers. These practices provide an opportunity for developers and testers to hear directly about what makes customers complain. PSS also conducts surveys of customer satisfaction with Microsoft products, customer support, and the company overall. In addition, it cooperates with marketing groups to research how customers use products made by Microsoft and its competitors. Microsoft also releases instrumented versions of its products that track every keystroke and mouse click to create an electronic record of how users actually use products. The cycle then repeats. It is clear from this sequence of activities, which Microsoft did not follow systematically before 1990, that customer support and customer feedback have become tightly integrated with improving products and the development process. The benefits are twofold: reduce support costs and increase sales by creating more satisfied customers. An application for a quality award that Microsoft submitted in 1993 describes this philosophy for customer support. Microsoft's support philosophy emphasizes that every customer support contact is an opportunity to improve product design, and consequently, to reward customers with products that are more usable and less likely to require attention from a product support organization. As practiced at Microsoft, this customer-driven approach to product design changes the goals of the software development cycle. Previously, developers focused on computer design goals. They felt satisfied if they implemented elegant designs without extra coding. Now they feel satisfied if they implement features that users can understand on first use. The first step in implementing usability at Microsoft is to learn what tasks users face and how they use software to accomplish them. This data helps to decide the appropriate feature set for new or enhanced software. PSS staff work with product developers at every stage of this information gathering process, using data from customer contacts and assisting in special testing and analysis. Product support strategy and organization. Microsoft has had a public image as being relatively unresponsive to customers. It has released products that are hard to use, such as MS-DOS compared to Apple's Macintosh operating system, and slow and clumsy for some sets of users, such as Macintosh Word 6.0. It has survived a reputation for not paying much attention to customer support, at least compared to WordPerfect, known for unlimited and usually excellent support on a toll-free line. Richard Barth, a senior product manager for Windows NT, recalled the old days. It was a laugh if you thought about what you put up with as a customer for support 3 to 5 years ago. You could call us only during certain hours. You might or might not get somebody who knew what the hell they were doing. We had some very, very talented people, but that was not a priority for anybody in the industry. In Microsoft, this began changing with the introduction of Windows 3.0 in 1990, and the changes intensified with Windows 3.1 in 1992. The new Windows operating system and the new Windows applications were selling in the tens of millions, and thousands of customers were beginning to call Microsoft every day with questions. In addition, Microsoft was in the process of shifting from selling software primarily to computer hardware manufacturers to selling mainly to individual customers through retail stores. Individual customers who purchased software were much more likely to demand support from the software maker. Market research also indicated that PC customers, like mainframe and minicomputer customers before them, were increasingly viewing support from the software provider as part of the software product. To keep these millions of new customers, Microsoft had to change. One alternative was to follow the path of WordPerfect, which is now owned by Novell, and build a huge organization to answer telephone lines more quickly and effectively. Another alternative was to try to capture information from telephone calls more systematically, channel this information and other customer data into the development organization, and make products much easier to use, thereby reducing the need for customers to call. A third alternative was to become more efficient in handling the rising number of calls, such as by automating as much of the support process as possible, and by charging different fees to discourage calls, make calling periods more predictable, and help finance the support operations. As it turned out, Microsoft would do all these things. Bill Gates led the way. He concluded during one of his Think Weeks, which resulted in a memo sent to Microsoft executives and leaked to the press, that Microsoft could no longer afford to neglect customers and had to improve its support policies and organization. He also promised the public that his company would provide better support for its new Windows products. Accordingly, Microsoft significantly expanded the number of people it has answering phones. This rose from a couple dozen in the mid-1980s to more than 2,000 in the United States alone, almost one out of five of Microsoft's U.S. employees. Another 1,000 support personnel work overseas in 36 countries. Microsoft organizes the phone technicians by product groups. All told, they support approximately 200 products. Trish May, an MBA from the University of Wisconsin and former director of marketing for product support services, recalled the transition that Microsoft has undergone. I'd say the turning point was about 2.5 years ago. It was in two places. One was when Bill publicly stated in a forum that support is a very important part of our business, and we will ensure that when you call on Microsoft Windows, and this was at the Windows 3 launch, you will be assured of getting high-quality support. The other was the internal memo that eventually made its way to the press that Bill wrote about in his Bill Think Week piece. One of the comments was that he wanted to invest in product support and that it was an important part of the business and that it was going to continue to be an important part of the business. We have research that shows that it's an integral part. And so, approximately 2.5 years ago, we significantly increased the amount of investment and brought in a management organization to focus on how we really enhance this. May acknowledged that there were two pillars to the new strategy. One was to make products easier to use, and the other was to build up the support organization. The latter included initiatives to automate as much as possible and make customers more self-sufficient by providing more information to them, such as through CD-ROM disks. May said that Microsoft studied WordPerfect, but did not want to duplicate its costly and free support organization. The strategy has two parts to it. One is to reduce the amount of calls that we'll have in the end by designing a user interface and product to address questions in advance, and having support and documentation that will reduce the number of questions. But the other strategy is a very significant investment to ensure that the quality of the service that we deliver is high. And so I would say it's an equal degree of emphasis. We've looked at the way WordPerfect administers support, for example, and we're learning from them. But we also look at how you most efficiently and effectively deliver high-quality support. What are the attributes that drive satisfaction? So, with an input-output model, let's look at where can you get the most efficient spike in customer satisfaction by affecting what attributes, and really fine-tuning that model. Our goal is, for every dollar spent, how do you move that dial most effectively? When you look at what we call our one-to-one incidents versus our one-to-many, which is electronic services, 2 years ago, I believe over 80% of the incidents we had were handled by people over the phone. Today, only 50% of our incidents are handled by people. The other 50% are handled electronically through forums, our fast tip service, our bulletin boards, and other electronic medium, which expands our reach more cost-effectively. So we've significantly invested in how we deliver the service and what is a cost-effective way to reach more people. Calls, data, and handling. As Bill Gates noted in his list of company strengths in product development, see Chapter 1, the enormous number of calls to Microsoft provides an extraordinary opportunity to analyze customer needs and frustrations. Microsoft receives approximately 60,000 inquiry incidents per day, 40,000 electronic queries by computer and touchtone telephone, and 20,000 phone calls handled personally by support engineers. The telephone calls average about one for every three product units or boxes sold, a significant improvement over the one call for every 1.5 to 2 boxes that Microsoft experienced several years ago. Each telephone call into PSS averages about 12 minutes in length. Support engineers spend 5 to 7 minutes diagnosing the problem, 2 to 3 minutes discussing a solution, and 1 to 2 minutes closing the conversation. The average delay for answering calls was about 4 minutes in 1991. This dropped to between 1 and 2 minutes during 1992 and 1993, despite a doubling of the number of calls. Microsoft answers about 80% of the calls in less than 1 minute. Detailed analyses of call patterns provide much useful information on how to improve products to reduce the number of calls. The data also suggest how to price services to discourage calls, or at least make call demand more predictable. Telephone calls analysis. People who call PSS are in the minority of customers. Microsoft data indicates that 70% of software users never call, and 15% of customers generate 70% of the call volume. Most people who call only do so once or twice per product, and usually within the first 90 days after a purchase, when calls are free. Historical data indicates that 40 to 60% of calls in the first 90 days relate to setting up or installing the software. Other common questions concern printing, usage of new or changed features, the operating environment, and interoperability with other products. Most users first resort to asking a neighbor for help if they have a problem. Then they will go to the product's help files, the manual, or the retailer that sold them their computer or the software. Because calling Microsoft's customer support lines is the last resort for most customers, Understanding the needs of this select group of users is important to reduce the number of calls. Studying these people has encouraged Microsoft to make certain features easier to use, as well as to offer better help files and manuals. Microsoft also decided to provide more information and training to computer retailers, software consulting firms, and experienced users who tend to help people around them. Microsoft also knows which type of products generate the most calls and over what periods of time. In 1993, for example, 70% of all calls came for the five products that were among the highest volume sellers: 31% for Windows, 15% for Word, 12% for Excel, 8% for Fox Pro, and 4% for MS-DOS. Microsoft also carefully tracks how long the average call is for each product, and the directly correlated figure of how much the average call for each product costs. The overall average cost per call is around $12 for Microsoft, below the industry average of more than $15. But costs, call patterns, and call lengths varied widely by product. For example, the average call on Word for the Macintosh cost Microsoft merely $7 in 1993, compared to $12 on Word for Windows. This difference appears to reflect that the Macintosh product was still a bit easier to use. Windows users also tend to call more often, perhaps due to the large numbers who have been switching from DOS programs. Microsoft used to ask each division to contribute equally to financing the product support organization. Since July 1991, however, Microsoft has been charging support costs to the individual product units. This means that if a group makes a product that is difficult to use and has many features that become call generators, the product unit has to pay for all of those support costs. Activities-based costing is the term that Microsoft has given the collection of procedures that it uses to determine the exact cost of each call and how to charge the individual product units. Mike Maples, driven by Gates's newfound concern with PSS, but also by his more general efforts to cut costs, explained how he became involved in redirecting PSS. 2.5 years ago, I started looking at the headcount. We had ignored them at that time. All of a sudden, I realized there was more headcount over there than we had in developers, and I said, this is a bad trend. So the first thing we did is we started directly accounting all of the product support costs to the products. Now, every product gets a monthly report of how many calls, what percentage of their revenue, what are the problems that they're having. It's been enlarged to be worldwide. The reason I started on this is that when I first came, nobody paid any attention to the cost.